on ABC Radio New South Wales. This is the Country Hour.
And it's Michael Condon here with you, and we're broadcasting on our digital streaming here on the Country Hour. And then, of course, we'll be broadcasting during the lunch break in the cricket. On the program today, we talked about the huge dust storms that ripped through the far west and central west of New South Wales on New Year's Eve. In the far west, though, graziers have been in drought for a lot longer. They're conditioned to withstanding tough seasons, but even they say they're suffering.
Up in our corner of the state, it is terrible. We just keep missing out all the time. Last night there was some storms. There was a line that went from Thargomindra all the way sort of right down, and we miss a lot again. We just keep missing it all the time. That little tiny corner of the state isn't even getting a little bit of a break.
We'll hear more about what's happening around the far west of the state a little bit later on in the program. We invite you to send us a text here as well, 0467 922 684, about the conditions in your neck of the woods. Maybe you've jagged a bit of rain. 0467 922 684, or it's just remained very hot and dry, and any feed and any water is evaporating as a result of the hot conditions. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. It's coming up to 6 minutes past 12. Well, a regional communications lobby group hopes that 2019 will be a year that sees the lobby group made redundant. The volunteer group Better Internet for Rural, Regional and Remote Australia is calling on the federal government to set up a rural communications hub. Now, co-founder and chief administrator Christy Sparrow says she'll put that question to Minister for Regional Services, Senator Bridget McKenzie, when she visits her central Queensland property.
So we're hoping that she can see some of the issues that we have on the ground in terms of connectivity. She's travelling to a couple of areas that are nominated for mobile black spot funding for the next round. So I think it will be a very wide encompassing trip.
Are you looking for any particular commitments out of this trip?
I really think that we would like to be redundant. So the BRRRR admin are all volunteers, and we've sort of reached a point where it has become an all-consuming job, and we'd really like to see some money and commitment from the federal government to help with digital literacy and troubleshooting so that people can troubleshoot their own connections. And it's not left up to a volunteer team to do the work.
Because you've really created a job for yourselves, haven't you? And there's been an advantage to that because you've been able to be consulted and be brought into the table when these discussions and these decisions are being made. But yeah, as you say, it's been a huge job.
Yeah, and I think that, like, we're happy, our admin team are really happy to continue our advocacy work. But what we'd really like to see is someone else do the troubleshooting and the digital literacy role that seems to have fallen on us. And I think, you know, providers really need to step up a bit too. It's not just a government role. I think we all need to be involved in how we move forward. Connectivity and digital skills, they're moving at such a rapid rate. And connectivity is now crucial, not only for business, but education and health and just, participating in the outside world.
What would that sort of a group look like, Christy? Are you sort of anticipating a troubleshooting organisation run under the department, under the minister's department, or what exactly are you looking for?
I think we'd really like to see something to start off, to start the ball rolling in terms of a digital hub where it could be an online forum to get assistance, or it could be a phone in. You know, I get a lot of phone calls and people, and they may just have the cord plugged in the wrong port, or they may not know how to choose the best provider for them. And I think, especially with the introduction of NBN rolling out in regional Australia, telecommunications is quite confusing now. And I think that there needs to be some assistance available for people.
And in remote areas, you certainly have very unique needs. It's not like you can say, well, everyone in Toowoomba is, you know, requires, you know, this sort of connection. Is that part of the complication? Because it isn't just a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, I think it is. It is definitely a part of the conversation and what makes it so confusing. For example, you could be looking at, to get the best connection to meet your needs, it could be an alternate fixed wireless provider. It might be an NBN connection. It could be mobile broadband. It really depends on your location and what your needs are. And I think, like, we, you know, we encourage people to look at whether they're looking at the speed of a connection or the data limits of a connection, the reliability or the customer service that they require. Everyone's needs are different, and I think that there needs to be a lot of work done in the space of how to educate people on getting the best connection and keeping that connection.
Christy, apart from that hub, do you have any other goals for 2019 for Burr, apart from being redundant?
I think we would, we'd really like to see, we're waiting with bated breath to see the introduction of SkyMaster Plus and what that means for regional Australians. And we'll continue to work with not only NBN but also the government and other providers to make sure that enhancements to SkyMaster can continue to keep us up to date with what the needs of growing digital connectivity mean.
That's Burr co-founder Christy Sparrow speaking to Jody Gunders. And Burr, of course, stands for Better Internet for Rural and Regional and Remote Australia. How's your internet at your place? 0467 922 684. Pretty slow in some places. 0467 922 684. In fact, we got a photo that was texted to us yesterday, and I think it was Viv from Yuabalong West was saying it took about 18 minutes to download just one or two photos, which was a ridiculously long amount of time. It's 12 minutes past 12.
I don't think you'll find anyone any better than the people in Australian agriculture throughout the world.
The country, yeah.
The country, yeah.
The country, yeah.
Well, have you got a secret dream of leaving your day job and doing something else? Well, 2 years ago, Daniel Cordner was working as a fly-in, fly-out mining engineer in Townsville in North Queensland. When he was offered a redundancy, he took the plunge, and now he, his wife Leanne, and the young family are running a pasture-raised chicken and cane farm at nearby Ingham. It's a lifestyle change that he says suits the entire family.
Good morning, chickens. I think 10 years ago, if you said I was going to be a chicken farmer, I would have said you were crazy. Working out at the mines and working in the automotive sector prior to that, and I never envisaged being a farmer, let alone a chicken farmer.
Have you got a secret dream of throwing in the day job to do something that you really love? What would it take for you to give it a go? An injury? A redundancy? Hi, I'm Natalie Fernbach. Well, this was the situation facing former fly-in, fly-out mechanical engineer Dan Cordner. 2 years ago, Dan was offered a redundancy from his mining job based in Townsville, North Queensland. He and his wife Leanne took the redundancy as an opportunity and set up a cane and chicken farm in Ingham.
We've got about 140 acres on farm. Right now we've got about 450 chickens running around in our paddocks over the back. We run a mixture of the chickens and sugarcane on the property.
So what prompted the decision to actually make that tree change?
There's quite a few things. We were living in Townsville at the time. I was working in the mining sector, and there's a bit of a change come up in the employment status there. And we'd always been interested in the food system and where our food came from. And we had one of those opportunities come up where it was a decide to keep working Monday, Friday, Monday to Saturday, or to, yeah, give farming a try. We were in a financial position where we could afford to do it for a couple of years. It's been very liberating getting to spend every day with my kids for the last 2 years straight, and with my wife for the last 2 years straight. I really didn't think it would happen, that we'd have that opportunity. We'd always dreamed about doing something else and having a block of land and growing produce for ourselves and for the community. But actually being able to do it, yeah, it's been an amazing couple of years so far.
One big stumbling block to developing their Belisato chicken farm has been the lack of abattoir facilities to process the birds. Their solution has been to build their own at a cost of several hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah, for us it was a showstopper in a lot of ways. There is no poultry processor in North Queensland that will do small batches of birds. We were passionate about running poultry, so we really had to build our own. If we wanted to do it, that was the only way we could go.
So you've set up your own abattoir. What's that process like to just dispatch these chickens that you've raised since they were chicks?
Yeah, the day our chickens go to the abattoirs, pretty tough. For us, we're connected with the bird from day one. So when we receive the tiny little fluffy chicken as a day-old chick, through to the moment we take its life and then convert that into a product for people to enjoy. It's a very tough day, that last day, but it really connects us with our food. It's very different to putting it on a truck and sending it away and then having it come back the next day packaged in a bag. For us, it's all at our hands from day one right through to when the customer receives the product. So, it's very powerful.
What kind of options are there for distribution here or for you to sell your product?
The ice cream van sitting just beside us here is our distribution option. Again, there's not a lot of frozen transport in products. Because we are such a small-scale producer as well, it's difficult getting anyone to stop in and pick up our goods and distribute. So we really are right to the customer's door. So later on this afternoon, I've got to do a drop-off at a restaurant in Townsville. So,
can you tell me a little bit about the breed that you're running?
Yes, we're running Summerlad chickens. They're a slower-growing heritage breed of chicken. They take close on three times longer than your conventional Ross or Cobb broiler that the rest of the Australian chicken market's built around. We bought 200 Ross birds early days, and they're a very sedentary animal. They really just eat and then sit down on the ground and don't do a real lot. We had them on grass as well, but they're really selectively bred over decades to basically be raised in barns. They enjoy 26 degrees temperature. They don't like getting very far from their food and water. So they're a real hard bird to become affectionate with, which sounds funny in terms of being a meat product at the end of the day, but we're still human. We still have that attachment to our animals. Whereas the Summerlad birds, right from a very early age, they're out there foraging, they're tearing around the paddocks. They're a more, I guess, natural chicken. It's a bird that's lived a good life in the time that it's had, rather than growing so quickly it can't support its own weight. And I think, there is a bit of a conscious decision there that people will start having to make as these options come up. Up until now, there hasn't been a lot of choice. Even if you go and buy the best free-range chicken you could buy, there's still a Ross or a Cobb broiler bird. So I think there is the consumer's taking a lot more interest in the food system, where their food is coming from and how the animals have been raised and where they've lived. And, that's what really got us into the Summerlad birds as well, that we started taking that interest and asking questions and seeing what was out there. And, we didn't like what was out there very much. And this is probably the best, if you're going to consume chicken, buy the best you can buy.
Daniel Cordner was working as a fly-in, fly-out mining engineer in Townsville. Took a redundancy package, and as you heard there, he's for the last 2 years, he's been a chicken farmer. 18 minutes past 12.
The Country Hour. On ABC Radio New South Wales.
Have you thought about making the sea change or making the chicken change? You can send us a text here at the Country Hour, 0467 922684. 0467 922684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour. And we're on our digital stream. But of course, at 25 minutes to one, we'll be broadcasting in the lunch break in the cricket. So stay listening here with us on the Country Hour, and send us a text 0467 922684. We'll also be talking about the seasonal conditions in the far west as well. That's coming up shortly.
You're listening to the Country Hour
on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, new research has shown that plants don't like physical contact of any kind. Repeated touching of plants can reduce their growth, and now the studies have shown why that is. Professor Jim Whelan from La Trobe University says that the next steps will be to test crops and potentially develop some new varieties, and he's explaining his research here.
When we started, we were looking at fairly standard experiments where we were looking how plants responded to stress. So we were using, say, some chemicals or applications of some molecules to see how the plant responded to stress. But what we noticed was that even in the controlled plants where we were just applying water or whatever, we were also getting a response. So therefore, we had to investigate that further. And what we found out is that they were responding quite a lot just to the simple touch of a soft paintbrush or kind of or any other gentle kind of mechanical stimulation.
What kind of response were they having?
So what was happening is that, like, they, within 30 minutes, they were changing the expression of 2,000 or 3,000 genes. So basically, that, like, genes are kind of, you can see is that every organism has maybe 40,000, 50,000 genes, and they're code or information that do a specific function in the cell to actually make things work. And what was happening, 2,000 or 3,000 of these were changing upon touch. Some of them were going up in response, and some of them were going down in response.
2,000 to 3,000 genes changing. What does that actually mean for a plant? Yeah, what does that do?
Well, what it means is this, is that when you look at the genes, you can actually look at, like, what did the characteristics of them, like, again, like computer code, like, it'll each will have a specific function. So when we looked at those genes that were changing, the functions that were changing is that the defense response was being upregulated, but the growth responses were being downregulated. So basically what was happening, the plant was taking away resources from growing and putting it into a defense response. So that basically that's what was happening.
And you said this applies to any kind of touch, like a paintbrush or a human hand. What about other plants?
Yeah, it probably applies to other plants as well. It probably applies to plants like when they'd be blowing in the wind, when raindrops would be falling on them and other things like that. So it's probably like these things, I suppose out in the wild, that might be seen as a basal response and things like that, that would actually have it elevated and things like that. But yeah, it appears to be responding to any mechanical stimulation whatsoever.
What implication does this finding have for crops where the rows might be spaced quite closely together to fit more plants in?
Well, again, it's a trade-off in those situations. Like, I mean, if the rows are quite close together and plants are touching each other, yes, they may be slightly negatively impacting each other when they touch and things like that. But having said that, like, land is always good fertile land, and resources are cost money as well. So that would be one thing that would have to be optimized in any cropping system, is how close you plant the plants to how much they will actually not only touch each other, but they tend to shade each other as well, which can be a problem. So again, if we can optimize that when they touch each other, they don't have a negative response, we could actually plant them close and things like that. It is actually well documented that touching and mechanical stimulation slows the growth of plants. That's known for 30, 40 years. What hasn't been known is the genetic basis of it, or how actually the impact of that. So what this study did is it revealed the underlying mechanisms of what's going on. So now we can actually start to try to optimize those responses in breeding programs.
What will you be looking at next?
What we'll be looking at is we'll be looking at this response in crop species, and we'll be looking for that if it is present in crop species, if we abolish it, can we actually get a growth increase or a growth boost in crop species?
As Professor Jim Whelan from La Trobe University telling us, it's official now, they've done the testing, they've done the research, and don't touch your plants. They just don't like it, and it can reduce their growth, and also it can reduce their ability to fight back against diseases as well. You can send us a text, 0467 922 684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour about anything you hear, any of the stories that we'll be discussing. We'll be looking at the situation with the weather and the drought for the last couple of years in the far west of the state, the last 2 or 3 years, in fact. That's coming up shortly, in about probably in about 5 minutes' time after the weather. We'll be looking at the issue of the season around the state.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, Indigenous communities in Arnhem Land are busy harvesting red bush apples from the wild, and for the first time have started selling the unique bush fruit commercially. The local Aboriginal corporation in Meningrida is coordinating the harvest and has been overwhelmed by people looking to get involved. To learn more about the project, Matt Brand spoke with the corporation's Jonathan Buckingham.
So in the Meningrida region at the moment, we've got our red bush apple season going on. So what that involves is people living out on the many homelands in the Meningrida region are out harvesting the bush apples. which is a Syzygium species, and they're bringing them back into the nursery where the nursery guys here sort them out, and they then get paid at a rate per kilogram and get paid that day. So it's there's a lot of interest in it in the community at the moment, and we've got a lot of people coming in each day with loads of bush apples.
Jonathan, we'll have some listeners who have never seen a red bush apple and certainly have never tasted one. What do they look and taste like?
So they're quite big. For a lot of people on the East Coast might know Syzygiums as lily pillies. So essentially they're just a really big lily pilly. And they've got quite a large seed inside them with a fair bit of flesh on the outside, and they're quite a sweet and sour taste and a nice bright red. Really, really good.
And the size of the seed, judging from the photos, almost the size of an apple, yes?
It is, yeah, the size of a small apple, about that, that's for sure.
What have yields been like this year for red bush apples?
So for we've been setting up our bush tucker business over the last year, and this is the first year we've really dug into the bush apples, and we've just got over a ton now, and there's definitely more coming in, and the season's not over. We're hoping to get about a ton and a half this season, and then we start harvesting green plums, which are just about to come on here in Maningrida.
Where are the markets for red bush apples?
So at the moment, we've sold some to Something Wild, which you might have heard of, down in Adelaide.
That's the Motlop boys?
That's the Motlop boys, yeah, yep. Something Wild. So they've purchased some off us, which they then on sell to restaurants, to chefs. And in Melbourne as well, we've sold some to a couple of companies down there in Melbourne, yeah.
And do you know what the restaurants are using them for?
Well, we actually had a chef up here not too long ago, and he made a nice red apple crumble, which was real, and it had a green ant yogurt on top, which was really good. Everyone was pretty happy to try that out.
Wow.
Yeah, something a bit different for everyone up here to try, that's for sure.
And what's your hopes for this bush food industry going forward? Because it's early days, you're saying.
Yeah, so we're still small and growing. Our hopes is that it becomes a business that sticks around in Maningrida and doesn't go away, and is able to employ local people and provide a bit of alternative income to people living out on the homelands around the Maningrida area. And I think the bush food industry is continually growing, so I think we're in a pretty good place at the moment of going forward.
Jonathan Buckingham from Balwinangar, the Aboriginal Corporation in Maningrida. You're listening to The Country, that report put together by Matt Brann. It's coming up to 28 minutes past 12 here on the New South Wales Country Hour. Well, let's stay with horticultural issues. It's a peak business time for blueberry farmers on the south coast of New South Wales over December and January as the tourists roll in to get their hands on some locally grown fruit. Clyde River Berry Farm has been operating for 9 years and has made the move away from commercial markets to focus on the pick-your-own model due to the surge of holidays during that summer period. Owner and operator Alan Dixon says the pressure is on to push through the erratic weather conditions that they've been experiencing lately and have the berries all ready to go for the visitors. He's speaking here to our reporter, Ruby Mitchell.
We've changed some of the way of the marketing we do. We don't do any commercial markets now. We just do local farmers markets and the pick-your-own side of the business. So it relies a lot on the South Coast as a holiday destination. And we provide a bit of a unique alternative to the beaches and the other sort of tourist attractions. So, yeah, we're fortunate enough to have that influx of crowd or tourism right at that time. And that's our market we target predominantly for the after Christmas period.
So are you like any other tourism business in that you rely on that burst of tourists during the summer period?
Yeah, absolutely. It's dependent on that totally. The ripening sequence is too great for us to just rely on local picking, although we do get a lot of support from local people. But yeah, without the tourism influx, we would have to pick and sell to commercial markets.
And how does that work? So how much of the berries are picked by the consumers themselves, the customers, and how much is it taken to market?
So early in the season, we start picking about mid-November, and we take all the crop at that period during that period to local farmers' markets. Once we open for pick your own in December, we probably rely on up to 75% of the crop getting picked by visitors during that period to the end of January.
And you mentioned before that you kind of made that move. What enticed you to make that decision in the first place?
The whole blueberry market, the industry was booming in the North Coast, and we weren't in control of the price we were receiving at market. It was all based on consignment, so we didn't have any control over the crop. And there was clearly a demand for people wanting to pick their own fruit. There was a real surge in people wanting to know where their food comes from. So, yeah, we thought we would just sort of target that area.
And in terms of how the season's going, how have you found the weather this season and how are you coping?
This season's probably been the worst. We've had the farm for 9 seasons. This one's been the most challenging. It's challenging in the extremes, from colds to hots to wets to dries. And these temperature changes just over day to day, there's not sort of a gradual change. And also we had a pretty catastrophic hail storm here a couple of weeks ago. We were fortunate enough in a funny way that the stones were that big they didn't come through our bird netting. So we were lucky in that sense. But we've had trouble with ripening. The season's about 2 weeks delayed. A lot of unequal ripening on the bushes. So that means we've got to come back and pick them 3 or 4 times. Yeah, it's just definitely been a more challenging season this year.
And I suppose there'd be that extra pressure of having everything kind of ripened at the right time for when the tourists all come in.
That's right. That's a lot of, even the varieties we choose are targeted for that post-Christmas period. And we're struggling now to find enough berries for people to pick. We've still got enough, but normally this time of year we've got a lot more even ripening.
With the kind of increasing severe weather conditions, are you kind of worried going forward for berry farmers like yourself?
You've got to look at contingencies, and we're replanting some of our varieties so that we're getting a more warmer tolerant sort of varieties. And we're also putting in a bigger spread of varieties, so we get, depending on if seasons are going to fluctuate, we'll have something ripe all that time that we're open for pick your own. The other thing is, with the way the climate's changing, and there's definitely evidence of that on the farm, we thought we'd start to look at some alternative crops. And one thing that came to mind was the, which would tie in with our pick your own, was the dragon fruits. So we've put in about 200 of those plants. And so far they've taken well. They seem to just struggle through the frost, as long as it's not hard frost that we're getting. But yeah, they certainly come on in the summer. So that's something for the future, and it'll extend our pick-your-own season to the end of February.
And dragon fruits aren't something traditionally that's grown down this far south.
No, that's right. They're typically a tropical, subtropical sort of fruit, certainly around Coffs Harbour sort of area. They have had success in Sydney. I know a lot of people out in Western Sydney have had success, so that's where it sort of planted the seed with me. I thought I'll give it a try down here. Time will tell.
Alan Dixon, and now it's time to get some news headlines with Lee Brooks. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The father of a Sydney teenager who died after taking MDMA in 1995 says giving the green light to pill testing at music festivals would be a precursor to softer drug laws. Tony Wood says there's no way to prove such initiatives outside music events will save lives. Sydney police say a 92-year-old woman who was stabbed last night in the city's inner west was viciously attacked in her own home. A 35-year-old woman who works as a cleaner for the victim has been charged with attempted murder. Income-based fines could become a reality in New South Wales if the Labor Party wins the March election. The opposition is promising to review the way fines are currently levied and to look at ways to make the system fairer. And the family of a young American sailor who was forced to abandon her yacht 8 years ago might fly to South Australia after the boat was discovered near Kangaroo Island this week. Abby Sunderland was 16 when she was forced to abandon her yacht Wild Eyes when it was dismasted in the middle of the Indian Ocean in 2010. And Michael, I'll be back with more news in half an hour.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
You're listening to The Country Hour in the lunch break in the cricket. And before we do anything else, let's find out what's happening with the weather details. And Ashley Langey's at the Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So I understand that in many parts of the state it's pretty hot. I just got a report from Wodonga, and they were saying it was hitting the 40-degree mark there, and I guess they're not the only place.
Yeah, so very, very hot conditions over the state today. We're expecting 40 degrees at Cobar and in some parts 42 to 43.
And 42, 43, what sort of areas of the state are we talking about there?
So the west of the state is seeing most of the heat, so we're looking at high 30s to low 40s, and then in the east of the state we're looking at high 20s, low 30s.
Okay, so there's quite a variance there. How long is the, where it's hot, how long is it going to stay hot?
So we're looking at hot to very hot Friday, and then on Saturday we do have a change that's going to begin to move through the far southwest. So on Sunday things should cool down.
Okay, Sunday cooling down, what, for the whole state?
Yeah, so we're looking at on Sunday things cooling down throughout the state as we had the southerly moving through. So we'll see a significant drop of 4 to 5 degrees in the west.
4 to 5 degrees. Okay, so if you're in the mid-40s, it'll be down to high 30s. That's
yeah, so we're looking at 36 at Cobar on Sunday still. So
okay, so that's it's still fairly warm in that part of the state, but I guess that's what happens in January. So, and with this change coming through, or the reduction in temperature, I gather not much rainfall expected though.
Yeah, not a whole lot of rainfall, with the exception of the southeast where we could see 5 to 10 millimetres far southeast.
Far southeast, and I guess where you're talking about higher elevation, they might get a bit more.
Yeah, most likely the ranges on Saturday, and more in thunderstorms potentially.
And on the coast, we've seen some wild weather in the last 2 or 3 days or so. We're pretty windy. Is that all moved away now?
Yeah, so we're just in northeasterlies at the moment, and then we'll have a strong southerly change move up the coast on Saturday.
Okay, so we might see some rougher sea conditions as a result of that?
Yep, and we do have a strong wind warning out for tomorrow for the central coastal districts, so go to our website to have a look at that.
Okay, all right. So they're the only warnings out at the moment?
That's the only warnings current. We potentially could see some severe thunderstorms about the central and southern ranges this afternoon.
So that's when that sort of system's moving through, some thunderstorm activity obviously coming through as well.
Yeah, we just have a trough sitting through the state today, which could generate those storms.
Okay, Ashley, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Ashley Langey at the Bureau there. It's 22 minutes to one here on the New South Wales Country Hour, broadcasting in the lunch break in the cricket. And it's, as I said, 22 minutes to one. Well, let's turn our attention. We were talking about the weather there and, in fact, what's been happening in the last few days or so. We've been reporting on those huge dust storms that have ripped through the far west and central west of New South Wales on New Year's Eve. Well, in the far west, graziers have been in drought for a lot longer than that, and they're conditioned to withstanding tough seasons. But they're saying that this one has gone on for more than long enough, in their opinion. They are resilient, but they have to watch out for themselves and find some strategies to sustain them.
Kylie Fisher, Brendan Gabba Station, Yantabulla.
How far out of town are you?
It's 160 kilometres northwest of Bourke. Our boundary fence is the Queensland border.
So that's a reasonably well-maintained boundary fence, isn't it?
Well, no, actually the dingo fence doesn't go all the way there. I wish it did.
So are you getting dog problems there?
Yeah, not as bad as it just further west, but yes, they're starting to come in, definitely coming in. We've got one, the closest one was only about 4 kilometres from the house, and we are seeing tracks, so they're definitely moving in.
So that's an extra headache on top of what is a really ordinary season. What are things looking like at your place?
Up in our corner of the state, it is terrible. We just keep missing out all the time. Last night there was some storms. There was a line that went from Thargomindra all the way sort of right down, and we miss a lot again. We just keep missing it all the time. That little tiny corner of the state isn't even getting a little bit of a break.
How are people keeping themselves sane in this season?
Oh, look, I don't know. We battle through. We battle through. Yeah, I suppose I think you've got to support, particularly husbands and wives together and the children. I think you've all just got to support each other. And there's going to be days where my husband's a bit down and, worried about the sort of where things are going. So I think hopefully you can balance each other out. So when they're down, you can try and pep them up and vice versa. There's always someone worse off than you, always.
Now, I've been following your work on social media. You've developed quite a reputation as a professional photographer in the region. Talk to me about how you started taking photos and then how you took it professional.
I've always been interested in photography, and this is probably showing my age, but my first camera was the old film camera. But then I moved out onto a property. I was busy raising kids, so photography, like everything, just got put aside. And then gradually, as my children started to leave home, we've got three children at boarding school now, it gave me a bit more time. But I attended a drought writing and photography workshop with a group of women. It was held up near our home, and it sort of really enlightened that spark that I had there. It sort of threw a few logs on the fire, I suppose. So I started to get back into it again with only like a $200 camera, but was loving it. And then... I was fortunate. My husband bought me a nice camera about a year later for my birthday. But I think what really got me going and the confidence to keep having a go was I went in the Life and Light Western Region Photo Competition and I got first place, and I was really proud of myself. But I think that gave me the confidence to keep going. And so I've since expanded, and I now do some, I sort of do a bit of everything, really. A lot of the landscapes and the animals, and that I do because I just love walking through the bush with a camera while we're out working. I always have a camera. But, I do weddings, and, I just finished a baby photo shoot this morning, family photo shoots, and I actually really quite enjoy it. And it's interesting, recently I went to a lady's home that I'd done a photo shoot for, and she invited me in for coffee. And here were some of my photos all blown up around the home in picture frames and whatever. And it made me feel really quite proud because I thought in years to come, that little baby's going to grow up and look at those photos. And, I took them. And it makes me sort of feel special that I'm going to be a bit of a memory in the family's, life forever. Yeah, so it's good. Good to do.
It's also your way, I guess, of documenting your view of the Western Division, because it is a beautiful place, but quite often when people come here, they see it from the window of a car just flicking past. They see it at the wrong time of the day and they just think that it's this flat, boring landscape.
I remember there a couple of years ago, it was dry again, just like it is now, and I was out working. I took the camera with me and it actually surprised me what was there and how beautiful it is. Sometimes if you just get out of a car, get your little backpack and your water bottle and go for a walk, it's amazing what you'll see. The birds, the lizards, all the natural animals in their environment. And you do see the beauty, even in really dry times like now.
It's also interesting that when you live in a landscape, sometimes it's easy to take it too cheaply. You always hear people say, like the local tourist attractions, the locals never go and visit them. Do you think there's an element in there that once you pick up the camera and see the landscape through that lens, you see it slightly differently?
Definitely. You definitely do. And I think, too, when you look back at it on the computer or when you print it off, you do notice it, too. But I have been one of those people that try to visit the local tourist attractions as well. I've made a point of taking my children to some of them because it's true. When you live in an area, you often don't go and do any of the things that are going on or on display, and there's so much to see. And I actually commented the other day, there's so many talented people out there in so many different areas, and really we should be encouraging everyone. There's so many people have just got skills, unbelievable, painting, jewellery makers, wood carvers. There's just so many talented people. It's just really nice to see. And I don't know, I suppose it's in the cities as well, but in the country, we're not in the car for an hour to work and an hour at home, so you do have a little bit more time to perhaps pursue those hobbies or interests. And some people can make good incomes from those little extra things as well, yeah.
So especially at a time like now when things are really, to be brutal, they're pretty crap, how big a boon is it for you to have photography there as a stress relief?
Yeah, my husband said that to me. He said, I love that you're doing it because it gets you off the place. And I'm a people person, always have been. And I do get off and I love to meet new people and just have a discussion. And it's a break. It's a break from the land. So to the point that sometimes I feel sorry for my husband because he doesn't get that break. But I'll ask him, would he mind getting the kids from the bus when I actually could do it? But I do it just to give him a break as well, because sometimes you've got to force yourself to get off just to have a break. And even if it's only a day, mentally, I think that can really help a person when things are tough.
Particularly if, like, and as you say, picking the kids up off the bus, there are other parents there and that, you know, you're excited because finally the kids are home from boarding school. So it's a positive experience.
Yeah, it is. It is. All the parents are there, all excited. They can't. I'm the worst mum in the world. I start waving about a kilometre out when the buses are that far out. Yeah, the children think I embarrass them every time. But it is a good feeling. And you do. You're mixing with often people from the land as well, because a lot of people from the land have children at boarding school. But you can listen to their stories, and often it reminds you you're not the only one. Because when you're on a property, you're often so isolated that you think you're the only one going through it, or typical, the pipe's gone again or the pump's blown up. But you forget it's happening to everyone everywhere, every day. So, yeah, when you're talking to someone, they say, oh, we've just had to get the pump fixed, you think, oh, good, it's not just me. Yeah.
Kylie Fisher there from Brendan Gabba Station, north of Bourke, talking to the Sally Bryant. And, yeah, it is important to have that chat and sometimes get away from the property, especially when times are tough. Maybe you want to share your experiences here with us at the Country Hour. Send us a text. 0467 922 684 is the number to text us here at the Country Hour. Just debrief it here on the Country Hour. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. We're broadcasting in the lunch break in the cricket, and we'll be looking at the situation with the wiener sales at Wodonga shortly.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Well, the new year wiener cattle sales are underway at Barmawatha Sale Yards near Wodonga. Thousands of Angus wiener steers and heifers are being sold today, and Riverina Rural Reporter Cara Jeffrey's there amongst all the action. Looks like you're in for a bit of a hot day there at the yards, Cara.
G'day, Michael. It certainly is a warm day down here at Wodonga with the wiener sales underway for the new year. I'm joined by Matt Tinkler from Elders at Albury. Matt, how's the sale tracking along so far?
Yeah, thanks, Cara. Look, it's certainly going very well. Some outstanding cattle, you know, feature bred cattle for this sale, and probably heading around down the lines that we're anticipating. We're well into the steers now, and around about that $3 a kilo seems to be the mark either side of a little bit.
And how many head have you got in today?
Close enough to 7,500 cattle. So, quite a large yarding and probably a few more than we saw last year, and mainly due maybe to the dry end of last year. So.
And with the drought conditions, what's the condition of the cattle like?
Look, they're presented really well, to be honest. It has. It's been a tough year, but people are breeding cattle for these sales and they're professionals at it. They do a really good job. And we're probably back a little bit on our weights to what we might be in other years, but certainly the cattle are presenting really well.
And what age would some of those, what age and weight would some of those wiener steers be?
So we're seeing, most of these are autumn drop cattle. There is some lighter spring drop, but you're seeing cattle sort of, you know, 10 to 12 months as a general rule, and the heavier end of them pushing up to 400 kilos. So it's a mighty effort to get that weight in a, you know, 11 or 12 month old calf, you know, given the season we've had.
And with prices sitting around $3 a kilo, is that where you expected the prices would be heading?
Yeah, pre-Christmas we saw just a little bit of a higher mark than that, mainly on a bit of late spring rain. Obviously the hot weather we've had over the last two or three weeks has probably just taken the edge off the food a little bit in certain areas. So it's where we were sort of talking with our clients pre-Christmas about what the cattle were going to make. So, yeah, we'll see what the heifers do once we move into heifers.
And at Wodonga, it's usually a lot of northern buyers coming down to buy cattle. What direction, given how the season is across the country, what direction do you expect these cattle will go in?
Yeah, so we've already seen some good competition out of central and the slopes of New South Wales, Orange, Bathurst, Dubbo, back into that area, Gunnedah, sort of in there where they've had some good, you know, some good summer rains and got some crops going. There's also been some competition out of Tasmania, which is probably a little bit different. We don't see that as often at this time of year here. They're more spring or autumn buyers, so yeah, that's good.
And locally you've had some rain recently, some very heavy rains. Do you expect many of these cattle to stay locally?
Yeah, look, the Upper Murray region is still looking very, very good, and there's been some competition back in there, so there'll be certainly competition there. I guess the northern buyers really like the numbers, so they come and they can buy with confidence and really get some numbers and equalise their freight.
And the heifers are yet to be sold. Given where the steer market's sitting around $3 a kilo, where do you think prices for heifers will go?
Look, I think we've sort of been anticipating the heifer market to be around the $2.70 mark. It might go 5 or 10 cents either way, depending on the quality and the type. There's been a little bit of inquiry from people wanting to buy some heifers to breed from, which is great. You know, traditionally we see maybe some more feedlot competition, which we will see on those, but it's great that we've got some people with a bit of confidence to obtain some future breeders.
And coming up over the tomorrow and the next couple of weeks, what are numbers looking like and what sales have you got here at Barnawatha?
Yeah, so next week we roll into 2 days of weaner sales again with our Herefords and Euro cross cattle and other breeds. So we'll see similar numbers, maybe not as large as we'll see in the Angus, but I think over the 2 days we'll see somewhere up to 8,000 cattle. So, you know, some really good cattle and really good lines and good opportunities.
Alrighty, well thanks for your time. That was Matt Tinkler. And Michael, things are getting pretty rowdy here, so I better head over and see how those heifers are going to sell.
Thanks for that, Cara. And Cara was talking there to the Aubrey selling agent, Matt Tinkler, about those weaner sales underway as we speak at Barmawatha, near those sale yards near Wodonga. It's coming up to 8 minutes to one on the Country Hour.
My name is Rachel Nicol, and you're listening to the ABC Country Hour.
James has texted in on the weather situation at North Star. He says it's dry and hot. He says they've been missing any storms that have been about. So no luck there for James at North Star by the sound of things. 0467 922 684. Wouldn't be the only one in that boat, James, I don't think. 0467 922 684 is the number to text me here at the Country Hour. Well, oyster farmers on the far south coast have had a good start to the new year just by staying open. Farmers had to close for harvest for 13 days over the Christmas period, which caused some concerns about profits heading into 2019. The ABC's Adrian Reardon spoke with a couple of oyster farmers and with one retired farmer about the year ahead, starting off with, first of all, with Warwick Anderson.
You were one of the farmers that had to close for 13 days over the Christmas period. How did that affect you?
We were, but with planning, we were able to get all of our Christmas orders out just in advance of the closure.
How are conditions faring at the moment now that you are back open?
They're very good. The oysters are growing really well at the moment. Principally Sydney rock oysters, but a couple of years ago we started growing the native flat oyster, or what's sometimes referred to as a mud oyster, Austria Angazi, which is a different species. Yes, we've been getting them from a hatchery, working with DPI in Port Stephens. We don't grow a huge volume of them. They're a much stronger tasting oyster because they will grow for an enormous number of years. I'm not quite sure exactly how long, maybe 8 or 10 years at least, and grow up to maybe half a metre across. There's a picture of one down at Marimbula that's about that size. So they can be massive things, but we're just sort of trying to stick with the native shellfish that grow in the lake.
What's the year looking like for you ahead?
Look, it's looking pretty reasonable. We had a reasonable catch of little oysters last year in 2018. It wasn't as big as the previous year. Each year we have different pests come into the lake, whether they're starfish or different types of algae that grow on our baskets that we've got to keep control of. We'll probably expect a few more good downpours and the odd flood to give us a bit of grief, but generally the oysters can withstand most of that sort of thing.
Bob Simpson, a broken down old retired oyster farmer, yeah.
So what are you doing in the area?
I live here.
So you're just wandering around?
Oh, I still do a bit of work around the oyster sheds and that, yeah.
So how long ago were you in the business?
About 12 years ago.
And how long were you oyster farming for?
20-something years.
What's one of the biggest changes you've seen since your time being an oyster farmer and today?
The whole industry has changed so much with the invention of these floating bags and single seed spat and hatcheries and everything. It's all just totally different.
You think it's a good time to be an oyster farmer?
It would be now, yes. Back with the sticks and trays, because of the culling methods and everything else, you lost a vast amount of your stock. They just died from all sorts of reasons. Now they're sitting in the water all the time and they just go up and down with the tide. So they just don't die on you like they used to.
You know, they did have to close for harvest for around Christmas, do you think?
Oh, yeah, well, that's always been on, yeah. And it usually happens when you don't want it to, but it does, yeah. We used to have no control. There was nobody said much about what you could do. And you'd have floods and people would be harvesting and that wasn't good. And then you've got to do all your sampling and that and get it tested. And then if it's clean enough, you can open up again.
So you're saying they have more control now?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. The Food Authority has really got you tight. You just cannot step over the line with them anymore.
And that's for the better?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
My name's Shane Buckley. I'm the owner-operator of Wappango Rocks Wild Organic Oysters. We had 13 days of closure over Christmas period, and we reopened last Saturday. Yeah, there's 9 of us farming here in Wappango. Everyone was in the same boat. We were closed too early to keep our oysters for too long.
You know, you're open now.
Oh, yeah, it's back up to what it would have been had we not been closed. We've poured about 1,500 dozen into Bermagui alone since Saturday. So everyone up there is pretty happy at the moment. It was like dealing them out of the back of the car as soon as you drove into town. It was great.
So was there no real loss then for you?
Definitely suffered some losses, but water's back to normal and the oysters are as fat as you can get. They're absolutely beautiful at the moment. They're pumping.
Well, I guess from here on in, you're pretty busy, right?
Yeah, this is the full-on harvest now all the way through till we run out, probably in July, maybe August, depending on how far the season goes this year.
And what are you working on today?
We've got to catch up from all the oysters that we've just sold into Bermagui. So we start early in the morning and work through till dinner time. So, yeah, they're long days. But
now's a great time to be an oyster farmer. Would you agree with that?
Well, it is now that we're open, for sure. No, it is a great time. The water's warm. The days are long. The air temperature's perfect. So it's a great time to be working on the water. Happy New Year.
That's just some of the oyster farmers at Wappango. Finally, after having to close for harvest for 13 days over that Christmas period, that busy Christmas period, but they're up and running again now. It's coming up to 1:03.
Hello, I'm Toby Payne from Wagga Wagga, New South Wales, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Well, before we head back to the cricket, Australian market access has been granted to, of all things, Indian table grapes. Indian exports mostly to European markets, but imported grapes will likely hit our shelves in the coming months, coinciding with the domestic harvest between January and March. Australian Table Grape Association CEO Jeff Scott has played down the news and says it's unlikely that these imports will be a threat to Australian grapes.
Australia has to accept that if we wish to export our table grapes, as we do, we are one of the largest fresh fruit exporters from Australia. We also have to accept that other countries will be applying for access to Australia. Now, India, while they are a very, very large producer of table grapes, their primary export destination is to Europe. So I would not envisage India sending a great deal of grapes to Australia. And if they were to do so, I think they'd be choosing specific areas where perhaps there is a high Indian population. As we've found with Korea and China, when they've gained access, they've sent very minimal product, but primarily to the Chinese and the Korean communities themselves.
So you mentioned there you don't really see many Indian grapes being exported to Australia in the future, in the long term. Why do you think that is?
In terms of our the consumer taste and everything else like that. The Australian consumers do like Australian grapes during our domestic season. We have other countries that have gained access to Australia, such as Chile, who are one of the largest exporters of grapes throughout the world, and yet they don't ship to Australia. I think you find that India have very substantial markets in other countries, as I mentioned before, to Europe, and I think you'll find that they'll be continued their export program to those countries.
That's the Australian Table Grape CEO, Jeff Scott, talking to the ABC's John Daly. We're going to head back to the cricket now, the news and the cricket.